Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your radio reading service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading some more information from Bob Tart's book, Kitty Cornered, How Franny and Five Other Incorrigible Cats Seized Control of Our House and Made It Their Home. And if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to begin today's readings with Bob Tart's Kitty Cornered. In the last chapter, we learned that the little kitty, the feral black and white from the forest, couldn't make up her mind about whether to join the Tate menagerie or stay in the woods. Bob was just as conflicted about whether or not to pursue taking in the cat. Chapter 2, Dark Hour of the Walleye. It was still raining cats, dogs, and something that resembled water when I peered out at the stray a few minutes before bedtime and found her stretched out on the porch floor. She shouldn't sleep on the cold cement, Linda said. She had never said that about me. Grabbing one of my many pillows that she had consigned to our closet because it had failed her in the softness, hardness, thickness, thinness, or non-crinkling department, Linda set it on top of a cardboard carton. The white and black kitty took to the spot at once, curling up on the pillow for several seconds before ducking out the door to make sure that her passage to the outside world remained. Then she trotted back inside with a sheen of droplets on her fur. As Linda yanked down the bed covers a room away, I fumbled at the door to stare out at the kitty. Next to the door on a wooden chair sat Lucy. I could see Lucy, but I could hardly see the chair. The massive cat watched me work the little locking thingy on the doorknob through slitted eyes that boasted wisdom, satisfaction, and the urge to bite. She lifted her head an inch off the seat cushion, and though I knew exactly what to expect, I took the bait and scratched her neck. She scrunched up her face with pleasure, all the while angling her hippopotamus mouth up until I could see her jaw as it tensed on the verge of a strike. I slid my hand down her shoulder. She pivoted her head and licked me once, then twice, before flicking my hand with a fang as I jerked away. Her face absolutely, positively glowing. A vet once described Lucy's coloration as a diluted tabby. Imagine the world's cheapest dish towel, like the kind that I'd give Linda for Christmas. The stiff white surface is boldly printed with the image of a tabby cat, complete with an M on the forehead and bullseye whorls on the sides. Somehow, the towel gets caught under the washing machine agitator and finally wiggles free after 2,000 wash cycles. The faded blur that remains, ghostly gray with hints of brown and a few dull splatters from bleach, resembles Lucy twilight tones, complete with a vague M on the forehead. To make the resemblance nearly perfect, stretch the fabric in whatever direction significantly expands the girth, then sew on a set of false teeth that catch on your skin whenever you touch the towel. Empress Lucy surveyed her kingdom from the dining room chair. I had dragged it out into our seating challenged living room from the previous Christmas when my sisters and their husbands were visiting. The chair was only supposed to rest near the door for a few hours before scooting back to the end of the dining room. But as my sister Bet ducked into the kitchen for a plate of molasses cookies to pass around, Lucy pried her bulk off the floor, shifted it to the chair, and glowered when I attempted to shoo her away. I hadn't dared to move it back ever since. As I ventured another scratch beneath her collar, I thought of how I couldn't conceive of two or more dissimilar cats than the skitterish waif on our porch and the sea lion on our chair. Even though the stray and Lucy were different as night and not night, they had one thing in common that gave me pause. Both of them were cats, and every cat that we have ever taken in was crazy. Sometimes we got lucky and the good qualities far outweighed the bad, as with the sweet but demanding Mooby. Other times things went sour and we got stuck with a big fat nuisance like Lucy, whose only positive contribution was to serve as a bad example. The old saying, once bitten, twice shy, was literally true with her. Although Lucy and I had worked out our major differences, she was still a strong argument against ever taking in another living creature. I didn't even want to gamble on a fern. That day that I decided to adopt Lucy is seared into my brain like my first morning in kindergarten, the disastrous junior high date with Monica Plum, and the Tom DeLay episodes of Dancing with the Stars. The morning I awoke in a rare good mood to distant soundtracks of Linda emptying the dishwasher, I would spring out of bed to help her, I decided, even as I burrowed deeper into the covers and considered the dining pleasures that awaited me that evening. It was the day of the office Christmas party, an event which I had scrupulously avoided for 9 years. But the previous year I had attended on a whim, partly to satisfy my curiosity about my fellow workers' spouses, but mainly because the Italian restaurant where the party was being held was only 15 minutes away, thus satisfying my primal urge for food, companionship, and not driving too far. I had intended to enjoy the party, but it happened anyway. My boss and his wife had turned out to be excellent hosts, and the pan-fried walleye was equally engaging. As I luxuriated under a pile of covers, a cat vaulted up on the foot of the bed, strolled along the length of my body, and planted its paws firmly on my chest. I opened my lids to blazing lights of Mubi's eyes bearing down on me. Fearing a radiation burn, I extracted an arm from beneath the quilt and petted her. Purring noisily, she moved out of reach and sat down, straightened her body upward, and poured every erg of her life force into a stare that jarred me, even though the sheet stretched over my face. I could easily resist Linda's early morning stirrings, but Mubi's summons was impossible to ignore. I jackknifed out of bed and promptly filled her food dish before playing a round of dodgem with Agnes on the basement stairs. I didn't eat much for breakfast because I wanted to stay hungry for the party. Plus, we were having grits again, which I enjoyed only slightly less than a heaping bowl of sand. I decided to skimp on lunch and squirreled away my windmill cookies for another day. Web designer Dave sat across from me. I had never met a more affable soul and figured he'd be thrilled to discuss the pan-fried walleye with me. Strangely enough, he didn't have his mind on dinner at 8:18 a.m. and wanted to prattle on about losing his house instead. "We're moving," he told me. "Neighbor's girls bought a gun." Dave frequently regaled me with tales of his crime-ridden neighborhood. There was neighbor girl, the 15-year-old who sneaked out of her parents' house in the middle of the night, only to wake everybody on the block with her boyfriend's muscle car. There was redneck guy who hogged the driveway he shared with Dave, and he often told me about his cat, Lucy. I was wheeling my computer chair back to my desk, and Lucy jumped up on it. "She'll also jump into a laundry basket if I'm dragging it across the floor. She'll ride on a rug, too." Our cats hated anything involving motion, not of their own making. Dave also told me how Lucy would beg and beg to go outside, only to park herself on the porch, barely 6 inches from the door. She'll sit there for hours, watching cars go by. If she sees a rabbit or a squirrel living it up, she'll watch more intently, but she's too fat and lazy to run after it. Lucy seemed like a healthy alternative to Agnes, the bane of our local chipmunk population. I'd hoped to meet Lucy someday. I'd filed away the idea along with other vague plans, like digging a heated tunnel to our barn or staying in good moods for an entire hour. Why did neighbor girl get a gun? The house was broken into, so your house could be next. I'm afraid of neighbor girl. I'll be emptying a waste basket some night and have to throw myself behind the garbage can when she opens up on me. Now he and his wife were going to have to ditch their rented house in favor of an apartment in a safer part of town. But the landlord didn't allow cats, and then he said, "My dad changed his mind about taking Lucy, so she'll have to go to the animal shelter." I had hated the thought of a pampered 8-year-old computer chair riding cat ending up in a shelter. Surely we could make room for her at our place. I had a motive other than simply doing a good turn for a fellow animal. A 14 Mubi wouldn't be around a whole lot longer, and she was the nicest cat I had ever met. While friends, relatives, and everyone I bumped into at the local feed mill bragged of having a cat that sailed into their 20s, we hadn't been so lucky. Our first cat, Penny, had suffered a seizure when she was Mubi's age and had used up all her lives in a matter of a few seconds. Although Mubi was irreplaceable, I wanted a touchy-feely cat on hand to help soothe our eventual loss of her. Is she affectionate? Oh, very, he had assured me. Later, after living with Lucy for a while, I realized that I should have pressed Dave as to how he defined that term. But that day, two thoughts fought to dominate my limited attention span as I trudged out to the barn. The more important of the two was broaching the subject of Lucy with Linda. Much more trivial and therefore significantly more magnetic was the rapid approach of the hour in which I would leave for the office party. I didn't get much, especially for dinner. Due to Linda's chronic back problems, we seldom engaged in public activities that required sitting. Restaurants were out, and so were concerts, movies, lectures in unknown languages, and go-kart racing, unless I attended these alone. And what fun is solitary go-karting? Images of Uncle Sonny's Italian villa beckoned like a fragrant flower. What exactly do you suppose a walleye is? I asked Victor, our head Muscovy duck, as I herded the ducks and hens into the barn. It isn't a very flattering name for a fish. What if I called you Carunclebeak? Victor threw his head back, opened his jaws like an alligator, and panted, giving my question the contempt that it deserved. His fleshy face mask, which a duck expert had graced with a pithy-sounding term, caruncle, seemed redder than usual. Ramon, an uncharacteristically shy member of the same fraternal order, hung back in the barn from the undulating mass of ducks and hens awaiting their late afternoon treat. Apparently he'd been picked on. I suspected that Victor was the culprit, although Ramon was always a bit more skitterish. That level of baseless anxiety made the two of us soul brothers, so I tried my best to make sure that he received his share of table scraps. Tossing fruit his way was fruitless, however. The cut-up grapes mixed with cooked corn and peas sent a tide of gobbling fowl sweeping toward him, and he retreated into the gloom. "You're not going to miss this good food, not tonight of all nights." In hopes of distracting the feathered piranhas, I tossed a handful of grapes and veggies to my immediate right, then arced a second handful far back behind and toward Ramon. But this only succeeded in creating two phalanxes of ducks and hens. "You're going to bed hungry," I warned, but he failed to rally. I completely understood. Back in the house, I peeled off my boots, stocking cap, gloves, and jacket, decreasing my body weight by 72%. I kept an eye out for Agnes as I climbed the basement stairs, moving slowly enough to allow myself a moment's preparation before I broached the Lucy topic with Linda. Early in our marriage, before we had started giving orphan ducks, geese, and hens a home, Linda had been one to introduce animals into the house. Sometimes she succeeded by persuasion, as when she had talked me into getting grumpy bunny Bunky. At other times, she got critters in the door via artful smuggling, as when she presented me with Howard the dove on a wedding anniversary or Chester the canary on my birthday. Over time, I had developed a soft spot for them that was coincidentally the same size as my head. I loved their attentiveness, the grace with which they dealt with problems, their tenacity, and just about every other attribute that they had that I lacked. Furthermore, animals were just plain affectionate, including parrot Bella, who was always demanding neck rubs. I had been the instigator of Bella's addiction to our family, and now I needed to lobby for Lucy. Linda did both the lion's and the lioness's share of work caring for our animals, and adding one more critter might push her over the edge. As I squeaked open the front door, I could tell that Dusty had put her in a mood that wasn't what you'd call pet-friendly. "What's going on?" I asked. Dusty's cage was shrouded with his overnight cover. He peered at me through one of the holes that he had chewed in the dark green sheet. "He won't let me cook dinner. Because I'm in here, he thinks I have to do something for him every minute." That explained the parrot's shrieks I had heard outdoors on my way back from the barn. Howard, the dove, landed on her hand as she complained about Dusty. These animals. Speaking of which, there's a guy at work who has to put his 8-year-old cat Lucy in a shelter, I said, beginning to ever so slowly lay the groundwork for the case I intended to build. He's moving and, well, his landlord won't let him have any pets. Maybe we should take her, Linda said, deflating my argument in one fell swoop. What's she like? Well, Dave says she's very affectionate. Find out if he'll let us have her. I'm sure he will. But you don't think adding an extra cat will cause trouble? Behind the bedsheet, Dusty managed to free his bowl from its clamp and throw it explosively to the floor, spraying birdseed shrapnel in every direction. Linda shut her eyes and didn't say a word for a moment. Howard the dove clung to her hair. Anything but another bird. Anxiousness nibbled at me as I headed for the restaurant. Few things happened in my life without an overlay of unease. Humdrum events, like waking up in the morning, shopping for kitty litter, or opening an email, all troubled me to varying degrees. Arriving at a party was fraught with potential mishap. What if I strolled in too early or bore the approval of a waitress? Just as bad. I might be a tad late and doomed to wander from table to table, searching for my candy cane emblazoned place card. The weather contributed to my sense of impending faux pas. It was snowing, and since I didn't see well after dark under dry conditions, the wet precipitation turned me into a menace. The reflections of headlights, stoplights, and convenience store signage in the slick pavement addled my brain. My thoughts turned to Lucy and her fate if we didn't take her. The shelter was one-way trips for the majority of animals. Only the cutest, friskiest cats and dogs ever made it out of there. Not a placid 8-year-old fatty, no matter how affectionate Dave said she might be. I couldn't let that happen, and I wondered what it meant that I couldn't let it happen to a cat I had never laid eyes on. But it seemed like a small enough deed to do for a fellow creature, especially one that might hop up on my lap while I read a Perry Mason mystery. I collided with the frozen smile of the hostess at Uncle Sonny's Italian villa. I realized that I had made a mistake. My co-workers were in full celebratory mode somewhere else. Acting out of habit, I had decided that because the party had been held at Uncle Sonny's last year, it would be ever thus the actual invitation, which I had apparently never actually read, sat in one of 16 piles of papers on my upstairs office desk. By the time I found it, it would be too late for the party. Through wet streets, I drove the upside-down reflection of my car back home. After rasping out an explanation, I told Linda, "I don't want anything. I don't want any dinner. I just want to go to bed." I trudged upstairs to the spare bedroom, feeling sorrier for myself than usual. Curled into a ball under the covers, I wondered why tiny things tortured me, but this condition wasn't a recent development. Over the years, I had attempted to balance the emotional teeter-totter with prescription drugs. The best pills only took the edge off the anxiety, while the worst ones produced bones poking through my skin side effects. I had tried meditating but kept falling asleep. Eventually, I had come to accept the fact that I was a ridiculous individual. As I endured my dark hour of walleye, Mubi hopped up out of the shadows to keep me company. She'd proven to be a faithful companion in times of trouble. On the rare occasion when I broke down in tears over some traumatic event, such as discovering a hole in my socks, Mubi materialized at my side. She snuggled up against my leg, just out of reach of my fingertips. The first few times she had done this, I had written it off as a fluke and sat up to pet her, provoking her to slip away. But her fondness for my shin was so consistent that I realized she deliberately chose the spot in order to snooze unmolested. I used a trick to lure her closer. Pulling the blanket over my head, I lay as motionless as a frozen walleye until she ambled up and tapped my shoulder with her paw. This wasn't a request to be petted. It was a test, and I studiously ignored her. Were I to slide my arm out to stroke her, she would migrate back to my lower leg, so I pretended to be asleep. After a few moments of tapping, Mubi flopped down beside my chest and purred off into dreamland. Suffering with a cat was always better than suffering without one. The warmth of her body, the rhythm of her breathing, and her sheer physicality provided me with a nice solid anchor in a world that seemed less real than my overreactions to it. I tried imagining the balm of two love sponges clamped against me in sweet unconsciousness, Mubi on my left, and in another 24 hours Lucy on my right. How lovely to be a cat, I thought, and seldom have to think about a thing. That's Kitty Cornered for today, written by Bob Tart. Next week, we'll find out what it was like after he adopted Lucy into his animal menagerie. We've all heard about the myth about the cat writing reflex and how they always land on their paws. Here's a reading that gives us some more information on that. The myth of the cat writing reflex. While it's common to hear the adage that cats always land on their feet, it's important to note that this is not a guarantee. The writing reflex works best from certain heights. Research has indicated that cats tend to fare better when falling from higher places around 7 feet or more because they have enough time to reorient themselves. From lower heights, they may not have sufficient time to execute this writing reflex properly. This is why it's crucial for cat owners to be mindful of their pets around open windows or balconies. Even though cats are remarkably agile, they are not invincible, and falls from lower heights can still result in injuries. The benefits of being agile. The ability to land on their feet extends beyond mere survival. It also enhances a cat's hunting prowess. Cats are natural predators, and their agility allows them to navigate their environment with ease. Whether they are stalking prey or climbing trees or leaping from high places, their flexibility and coordination gives them an edge in the wild. Moreover, the agility is not just about functional survival. It plays a significant role in the cat's play behavior, which is essential for their mental and physical well-being. Cats engage in various forms of play that mimic hunting, requiring them to jump, pounce, and twist, activities that hone their reflexes and keep them in tip-top shape. The magic of cats. While cats may seem to possess a magical ability to land on their feet, the truth is rooted in their biology, their physics, and instinct. Their writing reflex, flexible bodies, and unique skeletal structure contribute to their remarkable agility. As pet lovers, understanding the science behind the phenomena allows us to appreciate our feline companions even more. It serves as a reminder of their evolutionary adaptations, which not only enhance their survival, but also enrich our lives as their pet owners. So next time you see your cat leap effortlessly from a high surface or navigate a tricky jump, remember, it's not magic. It's nature at its finest. Embrace the wonders of cat ownership and always ensure their safety as they explore the world with their charming agility. The magic of cats. Well, we've given a lot of time to cats today, so here's some information about dogs. This is about a dog that captured the world's most wanted man. On May 2nd in 2011, a well-trained Malinois named Cairo accompanied the U.S. Navy SEALs who killed Osama bin Laden. Even though we don't have many details about this secret but successful operation, every member of the team guarantees that the outcome might not have been a success if Cairo wasn't present to help. And then there's the Newfoundland dog that saved Napoleon. It's widely believed that a Newfoundland, whose name and sex has gone unrecorded, saved the great military general Napoleon Bonaparte from death. In 1815, during Napoleon's escape from exile on the Isle of Elba, a gigantic wave knocked him overboard, which almost led to his death. Fortunately, a fisherman's dog, the unnamed Newfoundland, jumped into the water and kept Napoleon afloat until he could reach the safety of the shore. And don't forget Balto, the humanist. This is the only time in recorded history that an animal saved not one or two people, but the whole population of the town with his heroic act. In 1925, the Alaskan town of Nome suffered a devastating outbreak of diphtheria, and the only available airplane in the area was frozen and non-functional. So several teams of sled dogs were put together to rush to Anchorage for the antitoxin. For over 1,000 miles, the heroic dog led the team, going through whiteout blizzards and all kinds of danger in the hostile environment. The dog's fearless journey is nowadays honored through the running of the annual Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and is the story behind the Disney animated film Balto, who is voiced by Kevin Bacon. Balto, the humanist. And let's not forget Leica, the iconic space dog. Even though Laika was not the first animal in space, it's without a doubt the most famous and the first to orbit Earth as the only crew member of the legendary Sputnik 2 in 1957. Unfortunately, Laika died during the flight, as was inevitable since the technology to return from orbit had not yet been invented. And those are some very amazing dogs in our history. Well, we've come to the end of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how those animals affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Stay healthy, be well, be happy. Bye-bye.